From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins. Sitting in today for Tony is our own Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for Family Research Council.
Welcome to the Friday edition of Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here at FRC, filling in for Tony Perkins. Well, the Freedom From Religion Foundation is apparently on the warpath after Texas Judge Tammy Kemp shared the gospel of Jesus Christ with former Dallas police officer Amber Geiger. Now, you'll remember Geiger, a four-year veteran of the police department, has just been convicted of killing her neighbor. She entered Bothram Jean's apartments last year thinking it was her own and shot him twice. And in just a minute, I'll talk with Travis Weber, FRC's director of the Center for Religious Liberty, and David Clausen, FRC's director of Christian Ethics and Biblical Worldview. In my second segment, I'll talk with Republican Congressman Michael Cloud of Texas about his recent trip to Israel, including his visit to the Golan Heights and the Western Wall, his conversation with survivors of terrorism, and his meetings with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. At the bottom of the hour, Meg Kilgannon, FRC's Education Research Associate, will join me to discuss FRC's new resource, the SPLC's Teaching Tolerance, What Parents, Teachers, and Administrators Need to Know. Not only will you learn about the insidious, far-reaching impact of the organization in public education, but you'll also learn what you as a parent can practically do about it. You can get this resource by going to TonyPerkins.com under Episode Resources. And in my last segment, I'll talk with Dr. Jesse Gill, the licensed psychologist who wrote another newly released Family Research Council publication entitled Safeguard Your Ministry from Moral Failure. You can get a copy of that, too, by going to TonyPerkins.com. Well, we have a very busy show today, but this presents a question about what is moral, what is true, and what is legally permissible. All of us have seen the video, which by now has traveled up and down the internet and social media sphere. You'll remember that after she was convicted to 10 years in prison and guilty of a charge of murder of her neighbor, Amber Geiger, who is a four-year police department veteran in Texas, has just been dealing with some pain, the outcry of her soul, the weeping during the sentencing phase, and the victim impact statements. She had entered her neighbor's apartment thinking it was her own, had shot him twice. And according to Fox 4 News in Dallas, after Judge Kemper sentenced Geiger, she came to the defendant's table and addressed Geiger, saying, "You got to forgive yourself first," and then they talked. Judge Kemp left the court, went to her chambers, and returned with her personal Bible to give Geiger. Kemp told Geiger, "You can have my Bible. I have three or four more at home. This is the one I use every day. This is your job for the next month, right here, John 3:16, and this is where you start." Bothram Jean's surviving brother Brant said in court that it's what his brother would have wanted. Judge Kemp went on to add, "He has a purpose for you. This will strengthen you. You just need a tiny mustard seed of faith. You start with this," end quote. And then the judge hugged the convicted killer. Wow. I saw the segment yesterday with my children, and if it didn't give you goosebumps or make you tear up, it really makes one wonder about what it is on social media you're actually watching. I'll talk now with our legal challenge expert, our director of the Center for Religious Liberty and the VP of Policy here, Travis Weber, about the Freedom From Religion Foundation's legal challenge, because, yes, they did issue a formal legal complaint. And I'll talk about the remarkable moment from a biblical and an ethical worldview. Now with David Clausen, our director of Christian Ethics and Biblical Worldview. Gentlemen, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thanks, Sarah.
Okay, so Travis, we have known the MO of Freedom From Religion Foundation for some time, and it appears that they have filed a formal ethics complaint with the governing judicial body, the State Commission on Judicial Conduct there in Texas, that Judge Tammy Kemp violated the law, which when I read that this morning, I did flush a little red, and I don't think there's anyone who believes that that may have been a proper use of a legal mechanism. What was their legal challenge?
Yeah, I mean, I think first it's worth noting that I'm unaware of anyone else who really seems to want to rain on the parade here. I mean, they're the ones who are stepping in this moment of healing in a courtroom, quite a rare moment where you see this happening and trying to inject some sort of complaint into the process. That aside, you know, the basis of their claim is actually unclear from their letter. They point to several Establishment Clause cases seeming to claim that this judge was establishing a religion in acting as she did. I think it's kind of silly. Aside from the reality that throughout our nation's history, people enter the public don't forfeit their religious rights when they enter the public square. They continue to act on them. They continue to let their faith shine forth for the public good in all manner of roles, including those of public service like this one. Even aside from that reality and that historical basis from which we're operating, their letter, the FFRF's letter, just doesn't seem to have a clear basis or solid grounding. We know recently the Supreme Court has made more and more clear that the Establishment Clause shall protect public religious expression and does not bar all manner of religious expression from the public square. We saw the American Legion case, the Town of Greece case several years ago. And so I don't know what basis they have here. I think they're trying to inject their view that religion shouldn't be in these places. But clearly, when you have this important, just powerful moment that we've referenced and talked about, I think the law should allow people to express religious beliefs in a way that contributes towards healing, towards reconciliation, which the law tries to accomplish but often neglects the spiritual aspect. Here we see that coming into a play in a positive way.
So Hiram Sasser at First Liberty Institute, which is one of the many law firms and other advocacy organizations that we work with, they came out condemning Freedom From Religion Foundation's actions, saying, quote, "Freedom From Religion Foundation is protesting Judge Kemp rather than joining the rest of the nation celebrating the compassion and mercy Judge Kemp demonstrated. We should all be thankful the law allows Judge Kemp's actions, and we stand with her and will gladly lead the charge in defending her noble and legal actions." So in your view, do you think there is any legal leg to stand on? Did Judge Kemp do anything wrong?
Yeah, here? I think in the eyes of a non-originalist judge, a judge who's going to inject the Establishment Clause with their policy preference, in the eyes of such a judge could find precedent to find some violation by Judge Kemp because these cases have been so widely construed to eliminate mention of religion in the public square. I mean, I think that could happen. Now, I don't think the Supreme Court would affirm such a ruling by a judge, federal judge, or other legal body. You know, I think the First Liberty's letter and statement which we reference is largely correct. People do not forfeit their rights when they enter the public square, including public service, such as the role of a judge. The contours of those rights are different, obviously. But here, there does not appear to be anything close to what an originalist proper view of the Establishment Clause would dictate as some sort of constitutional violation. So, no, I don't think she did anything proper here. I think this is actually helpful to the process in a more holistic way, ensuring that we deal with justice and the needs of the justice system by recognizing there's a spiritual component to humanity's nature and the actions which we undertake and which our legal system punishes. So yeah, I think the answer is no. I think this is largely going to turn out to be a sideshow to the reality that many people recognize here, this healing unitive component that she brought to that courtroom at a time when our nation has seen a lot of fracture, seen a lot of mass shootings, seen a lot of horror, as we well know. This is something to celebrate.
So, in fact, even the defense attorney, Robert Rogers, said that he thought it was part of the judge's power, using that power as far as rehabilitation was concerned, to give, in this instance, the defendant hope. And there is some element of rehabilitation and preventing recidivism and saying we're meeting out this sentence and there is the law, but the grace is what follows after it.
This is an important point. I used to do criminal defense work and would meet with defendants in jail, and we deal with what the law affords them as far as rights. We deal with their case. But the law often neglects the spiritual component, and these people – there's a reality that human beings have a spiritual dimension. We need to deal with the spiritual dimension of our actions. And the law often does not have a mechanism in today's world to deal with this well. And so when this judge steps in and actually helps deal with the need of this person for forgiveness and dealing internally with what they've done, it's very significant. It's positive. I think it should be celebrated. I know David can probably talk more about that, but I think this absolutely is something that is good to see in the justice system, broadly speaking.
So let me switch right now to David Clawson, who's our Director of Christian Ethics and Biblical Worldview and has written on this topic. In fact, you have a blog post up on our website now called A Verdict of Forgiveness, and you started off by citing 1 Corinthians 1:18, "For the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God." Which makes me think of the fact that people who don't understand this level of grace and forgiveness, it really, I'm sure, looks to them to be very weak and foolish, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And I think a recent poll said, 7% of Americans have a biblical worldview. And I think, like Travis said, the vast majority of people who are watching this, a couple nights ago, I watched the tape of the 18-year-old brother of the victim giving his victim impact statement, looking at his brother's killer in the eye. She's just been sentenced for murder and forgiving her. I have actually the quote in front of me. I just want to read this. I think most people have probably seen it by now. But if you haven't, it is worth watching this clip. Yeah. But just this is an 18-year-old man who's lost his brother a year ago in this just tragic situation. So I just imagine the grief and the heartache that this young man's going through. And yet he has the ability, the courage, motivated by his Christian convictions, mm-hmm. understanding redemption, understanding what reconciliation with God looks like. And he's able to say this, and he looks at her and he says, "I know if you go to God and ask him, he will forgive you. I want the best for you because I know that's exactly what both of them would want you to do. And the best would be to give your life to Christ." Mm. And since then, there's a lot of people, again, mostly people have had just a positive reaction to this, seeing these things unfold. But there's been some who've been a little bit negative. He was asked today on Good Morning America if he still stood by his remarks. And he said this. He said, "She made a mistake," referring to the police officer, "that she'll probably regret for the rest of her life. But just understand that God forgave you. I know that every time I ask for God for forgiveness, he forgives me. So who am I to not forgive someone who asks?"
Mm. What a powerful statement. And this is somebody who is physically in proximity to the individual that's just been convicted of killing his sibling. I don't know if I would have that kind of level of spiritual maturity and grace, but boy, I tell you what, it has a powerful impact on people who watch it, doesn't it? Go to our website, TonyPerkins.com, where we have these resources that we've referred to, including David Clawson's piece on this tremendous and remarkable display of God's grace and forgiveness. You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins on this Friday afternoon. Coming up next, I will talk to Republican Congressman Michael Cloud of Texas on his recent visit to Israel, including his visit with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, coming up next.
We live in a time of great political division, and this division only intensifies during campaign season. The toxic tone in politics can be discouraging, which makes it a very real temptation for many Christians to wipe their hands of politics altogether. After all, if God is sovereign and controls the heart of the king, as Proverbs says, do we really need to get involved in the messy world of politics? Because political engagement can be divisive, shouldn't Christians abandon politics and direct their energies toward more spiritual pursuits? Christians are called to submit every area of their life to God, which includes how they engage in politics. But they are called to engage biblically. This requires Christians to be prepared to follow their political theology to its logical end and vote for candidates and parties that support clear biblical values. For more information on the Christians' call to engage in politics, visit frc.org/engage. That's frc.org /engage.
News. We can get it from many sources, but what can you trust these days? Where can you get news that doesn't make you as suspicious as you are informed? If you're looking for something better, for honest coverage of the latest news, one trusted news source I look to is the Washington Times. When preparing for the radio program and selecting guests to join me on the show, I will often read the Washington Times and have their reporters join me here on the program because I trust how they cover the news. Join me and more than 7 million readers who turn to the Washington Times every month to get real, trusted news. For a limited time only, listeners of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins will receive a special annual rate of $69.95 for the first year. Subscribe to the Washington Times and get this special offer by using my name and visiting washingtontimes.com/Tony Perkins. That's washingtontimes.com/Tony Perkins.
Are you a student? Do you know a student? Well, this year, students can apply for scholarships to attend FRC Action's Values Voter Summit at no cost. At VVS, students will join thousands of like-minded conservatives who care about the issues that are shaping our nation. They'll enjoy our Student Mixer Trivia Night, topics covering everything from history to politics to the upcoming 2020 election. They'll hear from key conservatives, including Ali Stuckey, Congressman Mark Meadows, Dana Lash, and more. They'll have the opportunity to pursue influential jobs and internships with reputable organizations at our job fair meet and greet. Students will also have the chance to learn how to impact our world by attending our student breakout sessions. From October 11th to 13th, come to Washington, D.C. for Values Voter Summit. This is one weekend no student should miss. Learn more about scholarships by visiting valuesvotersummit.org/students or by calling 1-877-372-2808.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins here on this Friday edition. TonyPerkins.com is the podcast website. You can find resources and links for more information, reminding you also that Values Voter Summit is coming up next week, Thursday through Sunday. You can still get day passes, so make sure to check it out. We have an impressive lineup this year. Well, I am pleased to talk to Republican Congressman Michael Cloud, who represents the 27th District of Texas. He serves on the Oversight and Reform Committee, as well as Science, Space, and Technology. He just recently visited Israel on a congressional delegation and wants to share with you all the importance of the United States-Israeli relationship. Congressman Cloud, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. It's good talking with you, Sarah.
You too. Now, let me tell you, I love what you have termed the real stories of Gaza. We understand that this is an area in the Middle East that is subject to not only high debate, but high international security struggles. And this is a source of contention for both the Palestinians that live there and the Israelis. So tell me about some of these individual real stories of Gaza and what you mean by that.
Well, it was, you talk to the families who are there and it becomes, you know, everywhere we went, we heard people saying, thank you for the Iron Dome. Thank you for the Iron Dome. And, you know, one of the stories that, for example, just grabbed your heart is the mom who has three kids on a playground and one's on a swing and one's on the slide a little further away and one's running around and the alarm goes off for an ink bucket and you know you have 14 seconds to make it into the shelter. Which child do you grab?
Exactly.
And I have three children myself, and hearing that story and what they had to, the things that they daily live under, it's been just a paradigm shift for them. I mean, they still live in a threat that's hard for us as Americans to comprehend. But the difference that the partnership with the United States has made in their life and, of course, the relationship that we have and how it benefits us, too, is just amazing. Another one, you would drive through the neighborhoods and, like, every third house, you'd see this odd box-shaped structure that didn't look like a house. And so you're like, what's that? And like, well, that's the neighborhood bomb shelters that people go to. We talked to another gentleman who was telling us about with all the threats of chemical warfare from Assad, how he had to go out and purchase an expensive filter for his home bomb shelter that would keep out the harmful effects of a chemical attack. And, you know, you think how they're having to process life on a daily basis. It's really hard for us. I mean, we're not going to Lowe's and looking for filters to keep out chemical warfare. You know, it's hard for us to fathom until you've gone there, until you've talked to them, and to really just get a grasp of the proximity of how close everything is until you've been there firsthand.
Boy, I cannot recommend it enough to our listeners going to Israel and walking in that land. I have been three times myself. I have stood, and I know you did too, on the Golan Heights, where you really are given a sense of the proximity of the threats that Israel faces from Lebanon through Hezbollah and Syria in the background, and you can actually see decommissioned tanks. I mean, it really is enough to make your hair stand on end. So you also met with IDF, the Israeli Defense Force soldiers, who kind of briefed you on the tense military situation. What did they say about fighting to protect their countrymen every day?
Well, again, they live in a situation where everybody's alert. Everybody's ready. They have mandatory service. So one of the first things we did when we arrived was we had Shabbat with the family. And the particular family we had dinner with, the daughter was about to leave to join the IDF. And then a few days later, we met with some more IDF soldiers. And you know, the understanding that they have of what it means to protect their homeland, and every family has buy-in, it does something for the culture, you know. And of course, we understand that kind of in a different way, but it's different when every child you know is going to serve. And when you think about the whole peace process and the whole discussions are for peace, it's a very personal thing for them, because it's not just this concept. It's my child is affected personally by this. And so, you know, the situation there is tense. You're always on high alert. And what they've had to do to deal with the situation that's so immediate and so so local in pushing decision-making down, because they don't have time for chains of command and such. So often you have 19 and 20-year-olds having to make the decisions on, do we launch this missile or not?
Now we have about a minute left, but I do want to ask you this, because I know you had a chance to meet personally with Prime Minister Netanyahu and Ambassador David Friedman, and I'm anxious to find out what of those conversations stood out to you the most.
Well, first of all, the amazing work that's been done. We got to go to the U.S. Embassy as well, and you know, we've had promise after promise after promise, and finally, it's there. Because of the president's actions, and the ambassador had a lot to do with helping make that happen. But then to speak to Netanyahu and feel his passion, his love for his country, but also his understanding. He's really a world-class leader in a different kind of capacity on a whole different level, and being able to share the message of the great relationship and friendship, and how it's a mutual beneficial situation between the United States and Israel, like no one else can.
And what a joy to know we have someone in the White House that made the official decision to move the embassy to Jerusalem, finally, after years of previous promises by other administrations. It's so nice to know we have a friend to Israel in the White House. And I thank you for your work to support the nation of Israel as well. Congressman Mike Cloud of the Texas 27th Congressional District. This is Washington Watch, and I'm Sarah Perry sitting in for Tony Perkins today. Coming up next, Meg Kilgannon, FRC's Education Research Associate, on the SPLC's most famous educational product. Coming up.
Radical abortion laws in New York, Illinois, and Vermont are challenging the sanctity of life. These laws have lifted the few existing restrictions on abortion in the name of family planning and mental health of pregnant mothers. Americans need to take a stand and defend the rights of the unborn. Family Research Council is sending Congress 90,000 baby hats as a reminder that babies should be welcomed with love and warmth, not potential danger. Supporters have already funded over 45,000 hats. We are over halfway there. Join Americans across the nation and donate $9 to send a powerful reminder that young lives need to be cherished. When you take action, we'll send you an end birthday abortion certificate that will remind you to pray for born alive babies who are facing the danger of being killed outside the womb. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com for more information. That's endbirthdayabortion.com.
Are you concerned with the state of our nation? Do you want to protect and promote religious freedom, the sanctity of life, free speech, and our children's educations? Today we see a growing threat against our values on the news, on our college campuses, in our elementary schools, at our public libraries, and in our courts. Every year in Washington, D.C., thousands of conservatives attend FRC Action's Values Voters Summit. From October 11th to the 13th, come to our nation's capital to mingle with and hear from key conservatives who are bringing real change to Washington, D.C., and learn how you can too. FRC President Tony Perkins will be there, along with Ali Stuckey, Bill Bennett, Dana Lash, Oliver North, and U.S. House and Senate leaders. The 2020 elections are right around the corner, so this is one weekend you won't want to miss. We provide free scholarships for students. Register online at valuesvotersummit.org or call 1-877-372-2808. That's 1-877-372-2808.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins. And boy, we have a big topic to cover in a relatively short amount of time. Parents are wise to be on guard and active in their kids' schools. And if there is one single message we can communicate, it is that you are the primary authority, so do your own homework. More than ever before, parents need intentional partners in children's education. And Family Research Council, to that end, has produced a resource entitled The SPLC's Teaching Tolerance, What Parents, Teachers, and Administrators Need to Know. The goal is to help parents identify and monitor this particular threat to our values and religious freedom through divisive identity politics and a handy curriculum with an anodyne name named Teaching Tolerance. This is nothing more than radical social justice education, and it is created by the most flagrant purveyor of partisan ideas in the country, the Southern Poverty Law Center. With me now is Meg Kilgannon, FRC's Education Research Associate. If you would like the publication, and we encourage it, go to tonyperkins.com or frc.org/teaching-tolerance. Meg, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Oh, thank you, Sarah. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. And I'm so excited about this FRC resource. This is really something that's going to help parents. We can't fight the educational industrial complex on our own. And this is just a great booklet that parents can get the quick and dirty on Southern Poverty Law Center's Teaching Tolerance. And spoiler alert, folks, it doesn't teach tolerance.
No, it does not. Intolerance, it does a very good job of. But I will tell you, this is a massive program, isn't it? I mean, this is, they said the last time around, I think the most recent number I've read is about 500,000 educators nationwide. But give us some of the specifics on this program.
It is enormous. The Southern Poverty Law Center, of course, has a massive amount of money at its disposal because of the sort of fear-mongering fundraising they do all around issues of social and racial justice, quote-unquote. So they use that money in their Teaching Tolerance program to print a lot of slick materials, and they have a beautiful website with really practical resources for teachers and schools to use. Their offerings are many and varied. They have professional development webinars, which I like to call teacher indoctrination sessions.
Mm-hmm.
They have a magazine that goes out 3 times a year that goes to, almost 1 million teachers every year. It's just an enormous operation they have going. It's incredible.
And they deliver over 900,000 copies of their Teaching Tolerance magazine in 2017 alone. Now, this is an organization, for the listeners who are not yet familiar with it, that has $500 million in assets, whose leaders resigned in disgrace after complaints of sexual harassment and racial discrimination. And yet they are held out to be the preeminent authority at what constitutes hate and permissible speech in the United States, and they don't like people with traditional Orthodox, biblical, or Judeo-Christian perspectives. So, I mean, these are questionably sort of, I would say at the very least, they are sexually inappropriate, but they are questionably legitimate from the standpoint of literature and history, but they come in these nice, neat packages, don't they? It's very easy
right.
to just they plug
do.
And play.
It is. They're all, a lot of their materials are aligned to Common Core standards. They use a lot of educator bureaucrats speak, so that it's familiar sounding to folks and it all seems legitimate. And they've produced something, for example, called their social justice standards. And that sounds really official and like, this is something we should look at. And it's really just something that ideological partisans in the bowels of the Southern Poverty Law Center sat around a table and dreamed up based on a lot of left-wing social justice, thought. And they distilled it into a document that they then literally flood the public schools with. And then, as is the want of the Southern Poverty Law Center generally, they back up that free offering of materials, free materials, with a threat: if you don't adopt this program or if you don't use our material, then we're going to report you to this or that government agency. We may have to sue you because you're a racist, et cetera, et cetera. It's a really, they've got quite an operation going over there, and it's not to the benefit of public schools or public school students.
And they're working hand in glove with the NEA. You and I have known this for some time. Anyone who follows sort of union tactics in education and sort of how the NEA is the 800-pound gorilla, these are overt partners with one another. They have actually,
yes,
they've identified a new business item from 2017's annual convention in partnership with the SPLC, NAACP, ACLU, GLSEN, that's Gay and Lesbian Straight Education Alliance, National Center for Trans Equality. I can go on and on. The NEA will track incidents of discrimination, racism, homophobia, transphobia, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, and other forms of religious discrimination, except yours if you have a Judeo-Christian worldview. Meg Kilgannon, we have to have you on for more time, our education research associate. I am Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins on Friday afternoon. I'll talk with Jesse Gill coming up next, the licensed psychologist who wrote another recently released FRC publication on safeguarding your ministry from moral failure. We'll be right back.
Hello, this is Tony Perkins, president of the Family Research Council here in Washington, D.C. I want to invite you to join Luana and myself, along with Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin, former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, for FRC's Israel Tour, June the 2nd through June the 12th, 2020. Whether you're sailing on the Sea of Galilee, standing in the ruins of Capernaum, or journeying up to Jerusalem, Israel is unlike any other place on earth. You'll relive the final earthly days of Jesus as you pray in the Garden of Gethsemane. You look upon Golgotha and stand in the Garden Tomb. The reality of his story will come alive in a transformative way. This one-of-a-kind tour will not only allow you to explore the land of the Bible and the roots of our Christian faith, you'll also hear firsthand from some of Israel's political, defense, and religious leaders. Join us June the 2nd through June the 12th for this life-changing experience. For more information, visit TonyPerkins.com or call 844-872-5155.
Planned Parenthood is not pro-woman. For decades, the nation's leading abortion supplier has claimed to be the champion of women's rights, but nothing could be farther from the truth. Planned Parenthood has repeatedly violated the law and violated women, from aiding and abetting sex traffickers, covering up child sexual abuse, and selling the remains of aborted baby parts, to ignoring the devastating effects that abortion has on women's physical and mental health. From its racist eugenic roots to the targeting of vulnerable communities, Planned Parenthood is an organization that not only promotes a culture of death, but makes it a reality. In a new brochure from FRC, you will find evidence that will challenge your assumptions about Planned Parenthood and equip you with the information you need to be a true champion for women and the lives of unborn children. To order this brochure and to download your free digital copy, visit frc.org/Planned Parenthood.
It's almost that time of year. FRC Action's annual Values Voter Summit is just around the corner, but there is still time to register. Join thousands of like-minded conservatives who, just like you, care about the state of our nation and want to do their part in protecting and promoting religious freedom and the sanctity of life, free speech, and marriage and the family. From October 11th through the 13th, come to Washington, D.C. to attend FRC Action's Values Voter Summit and hear from key conservatives who are bringing real change to Washington. And learn how you can, too. FRC Action President Tony Perkins will be there, along with Ali Stuckey, Bill Bennett, Dana Lash, Oliver North, and Congressman Mark Meadows. The 2020 elections are fast approaching, so this is one weekend you won't want to miss. Ask about our scholarship for students. Register online at valuesvotersummit.org or call 1-877-372-2808. That's 1-877-372-2808.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here, sitting in for Tony Perkins on a beautiful Friday afternoon in the nation's capital. Well, here at FRC, we have just released a new resource entitled Safeguard Your Ministry from Moral Failure. It's written by my next guest, Dr. Jesse Gill. You can get your own free copy by going to TonyPerkins.com. Look under Episode Resources. You can download it there. Dr. Gill is a licensed psychologist. He is the clinic director for Psychological Health Affiliates in Hershey, Pennsylvania, and is passionate about integrating scripture with attachment theory and applies these truths to Christian marriage in his book, Face to Face, Seven Keys to a Secure Marriage. Dr. Gill, welcome to Washington Watch.
Sarah, it's so good to be with you today.
Well, I have to start by saying, and this is completely irrelevant to our discussion, but I love your first name because my youngest is Jesse, and we loved that biblical name because of his connection to the lineage of Jesus. So I think your parents did A-OK. So let's talk about your new publication. And I love this. It's so needed because we have seen too many ministries fall to scandal. We have seen people leave the faith. We have heard about financial misdealings. We have heard about affairs. And it is one of the reasons, I believe, people look at Christians askance. In fact, I remember one of my favorite quotes from C.S. Lewis, "Christians are the best argument for and against Christianity." You start this publication by citing Psalm 139:23-24, which says, "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my anxieties." So tell me, why that particular verse, Dr. Gill?
Well, it really speaks to the approach that I'm inviting all people who are in Christian ministry to embrace. And it's this willingness to open ourselves to God, let Him, by His Holy Spirit, search our hearts and see if there are any, potential footholds that the enemy might be able to dig into, which could lead us to actually fall to temptation. Temptation is normal. It's a part of everyday life. Christian leaders, pastors have tremendous loads upon them. So at any given point, we will face temptation. But if we are not aware of sort of the stages that we're going through, or maybe grief or loss episodes that we've been through in our life, or just which of our current need states are heightened, then we can be more subject to really getting picked off and becoming, you know, not just at the macro level, you know, like a damaging witness to all of Christendom in the world, but even at the micro level within our congregations, within our families, you know, we don't want to fall. We don't want to stumble others and, you know, step short of what God really has entrusted us to do.
So you talk a little bit about the fact that ever since Eden in Genesis 3, sexual sin has been with us for millennia, but you believe it's particularly tragic when clergy and ministry leaders fall into this kind of sin. Why is that?
I think it's the scope of the betrayal. You know, you mentioned that I'm a clinical psychologist and a marriage therapist, and so there's many forms of betrayal that take place. But when in a marriage, sexual intimacy is the most vulnerable form of sharing that two spouses have with each other. There's the attachment bond, there's the relational bond. And so any form of sexual betrayal is particularly devastating within a marriage. I think that in the Christian community, forms of sexual sin are so damaging because there's this sense that one who was called to shepherd and to serve not only stepped across the line and, for example, took money from the offering or something of this nature or from the accounts, but, you know, they actually took the physical rights of another person. They stepped over that line. They broke perhaps their own marriage covenant. So it's multidimensional, Sarah, where this particular sin is not at all exemplifying the nature of our God, who is a God of covenant, who is faithful and true.
And God takes this particular sin seriously, as he does all sin, but you reference Matthew 18:6. Is the church taking this particular sin, the sexual sin, seriously enough?
I think we are, but, you know, I think that we're missing something in the terms of how to really equip Christian leaders to care for their souls. You know, it's not too much of a stretch if you think about it to know that if you do good soul care, which is both spiritual and relational with others, and if you do good soul care, then you won't be as susceptible. So I think that the need is, I mean, I think we're all grieved when somebody falls sexually. But I think what we need more of is what this brochure is about, is how to really search your heart, how to be equipped, how to be connected to important supportive relationships so that you can care for your soul and bolster yourself. So I think that this is actually a way to take sexual sin seriously, not to stand back and wag our fingers and shake our heads, but to recognize that, you know, there's an incredible load that clergy are under, and we want to come alongside them. Yeah. And then we also are inviting clergy to take a moment and to do some soul searching for the purpose of stepping into healthier places with your soul care.
And, you know, it's so apt that you bring up what a heavy burden it is to lead in ministry. I remember a conversation I had with a pastor at a small country church that I attended for some time, and he came to me and said, I can't talk to anyone about my depression. And his congregation was much older, and there wasn't fully an understanding of the fact that leaders in ministry, pastors, clergy, ministers, they struggle with the exact same things that those of us, the rest of us not in ministry, do. We are the same, and yet they are tasked with leading flocks of sheep, often without taking care of themselves. So I find that to be such an important message. And you talked a little bit about attachment design. Now, this is part of our sexual nature as human beings, and we're talking about how ministers, leaders, pastors are the same as everyone else, but talk to how this particular attachment design is implicated in this kind of a struggle.
Oh, it's a great question, Sarah, and I love attachment theory. Now it's actually probably more apropos to call it attachment science because it's been so substantiated that close bonded relationships have a vital impact on every single aspect of our health, emotional, spiritual, physical, and even sexual. And so attachment is God's design for human relationships. It begins from the moment that we're born with our first cry and we connect with a parent who scoops us up and holds us close skin to skin and soothes us. You know, there's just this immediate sense like I'm okay and I'm not right. alone. And then children who receive the tender touch of their parents, consistent, I call it face-to-face, like the title of my book, Face-to-Face Gazing, which is the parent's window to really track what the child is experiencing and needing and also reflecting back to the child that there is a way to contain their emotions and their experiences. And then all of that is part of attunement, where parents really allow children to be vulnerable. They're vulnerable with them, comforting and also playful. And all of this sets the stage for us as human beings to be secure. Mm-hmm. And so let me just walk that right into, kind of what we're looking for Christian ministers. So two key attributes of secure attachment. So again, people who had that face-to-face gazing, tender touch, and vulnerable reciprocal emotional experiences consistently as kids, people who had that, they developed something called secure attachment. And it has these wonderful two dimensions. The first one is something called safe haven. And what that means is that, you know, based on those experiences, I know that if I'm in a place of distress or a place of need, I can just reach out. You know, somebody will be there for me. Somebody will be there to hold me, to direct me, to comfort me, to guide me. And so I have this confidence that I can just reach out. This confidence also extends over into something called secure base. And what that, think of a base in this sense is like something that you launch out from, that you can launch out, you can explore the world, you can fulfill your calling if you're in Christian ministry, and you also can explore your inner world, your emotions, you know, which is the whole reason that I have a job, for example, is because the realm of feelings is, it is complicated, you know, but people who had somebody tend to those when they were kids, they're much more equipped. And of course, I can walk this right into clergy and clergy soul care. So what we're looking at there is, again, that we want for clergy to have the safe haven. We want for them to have, if they're married, we want them to have this with their spouse. They can turn to their spouse. And even if they're married, we want them to have a close friend or a trusted advisor that they can turn to so that when they're in need, when they're distressed, they won't be alone and they won't implode, nor will they act out, you know. And we want for them to have the secure base as well, which means that they can explore what they're going through with a sense of safety. You know, it's a process in my line of work, as I mentioned, to sort out, you know, what are the emotional signals telling me, you know, about what I'm going through, about what the need states are that are activated. And so we want for clergy to be able to have relationships as adults that embody these attributes. They can turn for support, and they can also turn to explore. And then, you know, even as we started today, that you can turn to the Lord and say, "Search my heart, know my anxious thoughts, and see if there be any wicked way in me, any place that gives the enemy a foothold."
So you talked a little bit about need states. I heard you reference that. You talked in this pamphlet, this piece of work about how there are particularly intense need states for pastors. Can you describe some of those so that the pastors, the ministry leaders that are listening might know what to look out for?
Absolutely. And so, you know, when we talk about attachment theory, it is a theory about what we do when we are in need. So everybody has needs, right? So like it's not bad to have needs or have need states. And generally speaking, as adults, of course, we're not as needy as kids. And so we do have to be self-reliant. Like we've internalized God's faithfulness and his mercy and the love of other people. And so there's a lot of things that as adults we can handle. And I think pastors have particularly broad shoulders. You know, I think there's this process of selection that takes place if you're going to be a person who wants to take care of others, teach the word, guide and lead. You know, you've got pretty broad shoulders. So I just want to say that right out of the gate to pastors that, you know, we know that you all are strong, but you are human too. And so
right.
when you have a need state, it's important to be aware of it. So not just to say, you know, I can get through this. No, it's I can get through this on my own merits, in my own strength. That's not the way of human attachment, and nor is that the way of us as Christians, you know. So some examples of high need states would be if I'm going through seasons of grief and loss. And so I think of it this way. It could be both that I've got just a lot of parishioners who are ill, or there are a lot of parishioners that are dying. I mentioned that three of my closest friends are pastors, and a couple, you know, one of them is retired mm-hmm. now. And so through the years, I've had more than one pastor breakfast that, you know, was scheduled for me and my friend, and they had to cancel because they're like, well, Jesse, I've got, you know, two funerals this week, you know. So there's these seasons where in the regular course of your parish life, you've got folks that are dying, and there's so much need for care in those moments. So that's a drain, as well as you know, tremendous responsibility and an honor, but it's a drain. Maybe it's a season of grief in your own life. Maybe, you know, you had a family member that died or somebody who was ill. So seasons of grief and loss. Seasons of stress, it's such a broad word, but if you think of anything that compels you to be continuously active and you can't rest, seasons of boredom, you know, where you've kind of gotten into a lull, or even seasons of triumph. You've achieved some pinnacle and you're looking around and saying, now what? Seasons of, you know, facing our own aging and mortality, seasons of invisibility and loneliness. These are seasons where we are particularly heightened in our need states. And that's when we need to be aware of the importance of extra soul care and turning to trusted others to lean on them and not try to shoulder it ourselves.
Dr. Jesse Gill, who is a licensed psychologist and the author of our latest resource for pastors. It is one you'll want to pick up, Safeguard Your Ministry from Moral Failure. You can download it from our TonyPerkins.com site. I have been Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins on this Friday afternoon. Thanks for being with us on Washington Watch.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.